Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by ELAC A25. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. Are you recovered from staying up late to watch some of the tourney games last night?
I'm old. I go to bed.
Oh, so you missed Samford. They got robbed.
Yeah. They got robbed.
You see the replays of that?
Here's an idea. Don't make it so close that you get robbed.
They came back from 20 down. So okay. You got to give them that.
And don't be 20 down. That's my opinion. Anybody who's going to blame a ref.
No, I'm not blaming a ref.
I have no time for it.
I'm not blaming a ref. That was a bad call. It was clean block.
That's blaming a ref.
No.
You can't say that's a bad call and then not blame the ref. Who else made the call?
They didn't need to put themselves in that position. Separate from that, you can acknowledge that that was a clean block. The guy fell because he decided to hang on the rim. There was nothing wrong with that play.
And there were no other calls that went Samford's way at any point during that game.
Not making commentary on the refs. I'm making commentary on that.
That is
call.
The most disingenuous thing you have said in 7 years on the show.
No, I say plenty of that disingenuous things.
I'm not
things.
Blaming the ref, but it was a bad call.
You are blaming the ref. No, wait. A team can put themselves in a position
that they shouldn't need. You can split it out. Don't say that you're not blaming the ref. You are blaming the ref because the ref is the human who made the call.
You can't question the call without it being blaming the ref. Like, I'm not blaming the ref for them losing.
Who else would you blame?
I'm not blaming the ref for them losing. They were down 20 points. They put themselves in that position.
You're focusing on a bad call. You've known me long enough to know that yes, there's a human element. I recoil at the idea that we're going to blame refs for something when so much happens, because then the next thing is we're going to have electronic referees and robo umpires.
No, you're taking it like 35 steps forward.
Don't be that close.
You're right.
There are calls that go each way every single game. And anytime you blame the ref, that's what you're doing.
Wait a second. No, stop. You're talking a lot. Wait. I am not blaming the ref.
I'll be glad to stop talking.
There was a bad call. There might have been bad calls on both sides. The refs take care of the game. The players put themselves in that position. But you can say that in that moment, it was the wrong call. It's just a statement of fact. Now let's move on to other stuff.
Well, wait. Saying something's a wrong call is not a statement of fact.
It was a wrong
call.
That's
an opinion.
Where was the actual foul?
Huh?
Where was the actual foul?
Okay.
I'm not saying that's
guess
game.
What? I'm not losing sleep over Samford not making it to the second round.
No, you don't lose sleep over anything. You just go to bed and check.
No, I go to bed.
Yeah, you're in. But I just look.
When I'm tired, I'm tired. Yes. That's what replay's for.
It's over for you. And we'll have more shortly when we're joined by Gary Waters to talk all of this. And then later in the show, we've got plenty of football talk with Michael Lombardi. All right, Jeff, you're saved from our argument about refs and their influence on the game. Let's bring on Coach Gary Waters, author, former coach, very interested spectator this time of year. Coach, thank you for rescuing Jeff. He objected to my criticizing a call in a basketball game last night. And
wait, hold on. Don't rescue me for this. So Coach, Jason's talking about last night that there was a call at the end of the Samford game.
Yeah.
My point is that there are calls that go both ways in the course of a game,
and that you should never blame if
you made the game close enough, that you shouldn't be blaming a ref who's a human for a call impacting the end of a game, because there were calls all during the course of a game.
And my point is that the team shouldn't have put themselves in that position going down 20. And there were calls that went the wrong way on both sides, but it's not blaming the ref to question whether the call was actually wrong in that moment.
Well, Jeff, I tell you, he's kind of got some validity there.
Jeff, I'm going to clip that, and I will be using it regularly.
He has so changed his argument, but you've been in those situations, I'm sure. So how do you deal with that, and what do you say to your players?
Well, you know, at the moment, everyone's frustrated because those situations occur. But similar to what Jason said, that you got to tell them that, hey, you were your team. If we're talking about your team, you know, you can't blame one call on the game. You gotta go back and you gotta look at the things that went on through the game. And you should not have put yourself in that situation because we're a better team, that kind of concept. However, I think they should have today, like, you know, in the NBA, they got some, you can check things in the rules today. They should have something at the end of the game that you get one check situation. So they're going to have to change the rule. Right now, it is what it is. It's the human error, and you can't do anything about it.
So since you're talking about replay, essentially,
yeah,
there was another interesting situation that happened at the beginning of this tournament in the Gonzaga game. Mark Few had to tell them to turn off the other game that was literally playing on the scoreboard as their game was going on. So
I thought that was crazy.
His point was, you're literally impacting the live game because people were cheering as players are shooting free throws about another game. And his second point is, look, if you're not that interested in this game that you need to watch another one, then let somebody else come to the game and sit there. How would you feel if you were in a tight NCAA tournament game or any type game, and all of a sudden on the scoreboard, there's another game playing?
Man, I thought that was crazy. That shouldn't have been. I mean, that was really, really crazy. And they got to figure out a way not to let something like that happen, because that couldn't, you know, it just happened. The game they were in, it wasn't a tight game. But just think if it is. I mean, that could turn out to be disastrous.
Yeah, that was unbelievable to see. I mean, there's so many different storylines here. You see the game last night with Kentucky going down. Obviously, there's the implications for, you know, what Kentucky does there. I'm more fascinated by the Oakland coach, who spent 40 years at that school to build that program, took them from Division II to Division I. The stories of those players. What do you think when you see something like that?
Let me give you a little bit about him, because I was in his league in Division II. And then when I went on and my career continued on all throughout. And then when my last school I was at, Oakland, okay, he joined that league. His Oakland, that was the league that they joined, the Horizon League. So Cappy and I, we really go way back, and I'm from Michigan, he's from Michigan. And, he's done some wonderful things there to bring that school from one point to the next. And that was a tremendous, tremendous win. But you know what? Kentucky, I think, messed up everybody's pool. You know that. I mean, that was the biggest mess up in history. I'm going to say that.
Can I tell my wife that? Because at this point, she's going to ask Jeff to make her picks next year rather than me, the way that her bracket looks.
Let's talk about that just a second, because they were really on him really hard, and they should have been, because you don't lose a game like that, but he did, okay? It is, these things happen in life. But it's understandable under the situation he's in. See, even though he's got a lifetime contract, he's making all his money, the issue that is there is he's taking young freshman kids and going into an environment and trying to be successful. And that's not an easy task, because they're going to make errors down the stretch, and they're going to do things that they haven't, you know, thought would happen, because they're so young. They haven't experienced any of this stuff before. And so he's taking on a major challenge. Now, being rewarded for it, I can't complain about that. But at the same time, he's taking on a major challenge.
Jay Wright spoke to that in the post game of the loss, and he said the era of these young freshmen trying to play against older players is over, because more will stay with NIL. So you're going to have more experienced players staying in school. So this model of bringing in all young guys and putting the team together because they're talented won't fly. Is that one of the ancillary benefits or changes that NIL is having, is that more experience is returning in these tournaments?
Well, I think so. And I also think that is a positive for the NIL. You know, everyone looks at the NIL and thinks only negatives, but that is a positive, that kids are staying in school longer today. And that was a concern, because you have all these fan base that don't even know the players on their team for 1 year. And then they're gone, especially at Kentucky, because those are one and doneers. And now, all of a sudden, now you can have a relationship. You can understand who they are. You can understand their lives, what they're going through. And then now you can support them. But the way it, you know, the way that was going before, it really was a tough situation.
Well, the problem, though, is you're right that players may stick around longer, but they're moving more. So the fan base is...
Hey, Jeff, I didn't say any of the negative parts of this thing, because there are many, many negatives.
I mean, to me, that's part of the problem is, yes, it's great that student-athletes will stick around longer. The problem is they're not sticking around in the same place longer. So you're not – I mean, a college basketball is very – allegiance-based. It's the alumni that kind of drive it. And the alumni are not getting used to, look, the Kentuckys are still going to have the one-and-dones, but programs that thrive on players sticking around aren't getting to have those players sticking around. I mean, look, I come from a school, Michigan, that's got all sorts of problems right now, and I don't think they have anybody left on their team, which is a problem, including their coach.
Yeah.
And Hunter Dickinson, you see, left and went to Kansas. So it's still hard to have an allegiance and to know who the players are, because they're not staying in the same markets or the same schools.
I would definitely agree with that. And that's a big problem with that whole concept. But you know what? Like I said, when we talked a long time ago, that I didn't think they prepared themselves for this. When I mean the NCAA, they didn't prepare for this. Now it's upon us and they can't control it. It's out of control. However, like I said, there are some good things about it and there are some bad things about it. And that one thing that you mentioned is really a tough thing about it.
I know they can't control how many people go into the transfer portal, but can't they control when it opens? The idea of the transfer portal opening right after the selection show, before the tourney starts. So you've got these coaches that are trying to figure out whether their guys are even going to stay on their team, and they have to recruit them to stay there as they're either prepping to play in the tourney or prepping for the end of the season, or in another scenario, deciding not to play in the NIT because they have to go to recruit now. Is that something that can change?
Oh, man, you hit it right on the head. I don't know if you know this, both of you, that I'm on the NIT committee. And I spent the whole weekend in Indianapolis deciding on teams. And at the last minute, we had a situation that one team couldn't come because of similar situations. So now we got to change the whole thing, and we only had 45 minutes to do so. So I'm going to tell you, it is. It's a tough, tough situation we're dealing with today. And I don't think there's an answer, and there is an immediate answer anytime soon. But they're going to have to figure it out. And here's the other thing I really struggled with the whole NIL and the transfer portal. I thought they should only had one come out at a time. One should have come out, and then they should have figured it out. And then brought in the next. Now they got them both, so they're using each other. I mean, people that are going into the transfer portal are saying, hey, you don't put me in the portal. I mean, you don't give me any money. I'm going into the portal. Okay, I mean, all kinds of things that are happening. And then what ends up happening is the coach gets fired because all his players are gone.
You know, Coach, we've talked to you so many times about character because of your book and who you are. My question is now about leadership as it relates to exactly what you're talking about. So you're on the NIT committee. As you know, Pitt and St. John's, I thought there was a third school, were selected to the NIT and said thanks, but no thanks. What is that? We're trying to teach young student athletes about competition and character. What does it say to those individuals when coaches and athletic directors are saying, we didn't get what we want, and so now we're just going to shut it down? We're not going to give you a chance to get better by playing in more games. We're not going to give you a chance to enjoy, for a lot of these kids, it's the last time they'll play organized basketball. We're just going to shut it down because we didn't get what we want.
Right. Well, you know, that's really a tough situation. And like we were talking earlier, there could be other circumstances involved. You know, like I know a couple of the teams as was the issue was concerning the kids that left and went into the portal. So they went to the players that were still there. And it was only, I don't say a few, but they weren't as many as before. But some of their better players were gone. Now, all of a sudden, you're asking them to go in there and they're saying, coach, we can't go in there. We don't have anybody. And wow. I get everything. I understand it, but we got to figure this thing out because it's only going to hurt the kid. You know, think about it. The NIL is so dominant today, right now. Everybody's excited. But you know who is hurting? It's hurting the high school kid, okay, because he's coming out and he's looking at this and they're getting older people that are asking for this money and then they're coming out in the portal and so they really don't have to recruit that high school kid anymore. And that's not what this thing was all meant to be. It was meant to have a progression that each person will end up having a part of what we're doing in this process. Now we're losing all that.
I just want to follow up, Jason, if you don't mind. So because I misunderstood, I assumed that the Rick Pitinos of the world and Caples of the world were not going to the NIT because they didn't get into the NCAA. What you're saying is very interesting. You're saying that that's not necessarily the case. It's that kids have left the school the second that the selection show was over for the NCAA.
Well, that's what Jason talked about it. You know, it came out at that time. And so they didn't wait. They just immediately left. Now, there are some coaches, and I can't get into that because I'm a part of that whole mm-hmm. thing. But that said, hey, you didn't have a great season. We're ready to leave. We're ready to shut this thing down. But there are many because of these issues that are occurring. Now, why are they going into the portal? I'm telling you, a large percentage are going in there because of the money situation. So you got a two-edged sword just constantly hitting you, and you don't know how to deal with this. And if I'm an athletic director or if I'm a coach today, this is a trying, trying time.
Well, and it seems like you see more of it in football than basketball so far, but you're seeing coaches kind of go to the pros, take assistant coaching jobs in the pros so they don't have to deal with some of this stuff. It just seems like it's a time of chaos in college sports. You've got the portal and the NIL issues. You've got a judge saying they can't enforce NIL regulations. You've got lawsuits with Clemson trying to leave the ACC. You've got Dartmouth trying to not accept a union while Congress scrutinizes it. As somebody who's involved in the direction and the leadership of the NCAA and the NIT tournament, how are you all feeling right now as you function in this environment?
Well, it's a tough time. I must say that, but it is the time. You know, we can't pull back. It's the door has been opened. Now you got to understand there's a reason why this door is open, because for many years people were being used in the process. And now a judge finally said, you got to stop this. You got to share all that's going on. And I get all that. I get all that. But you got to look at the whole process. And that's where the problem is coming. Think about it. You got a kid that's saying he wants an NIL of a certain amount of money on a football team, and he's the quarterback, and he gets it. But what about the other, 18 other players out there? They're saying, man, this guy got the money. I got a block for him, and I don't get a penny. So, there are all kinds of issues. And now they have a collective. I think you've heard of that. The collective where they bring all the money together and they're trying to do something. But they gotta work this out and they got to figure it out, because it's not an easy thing to figure out because no one prepared for this. But they
is the answer then, as much as I cringe at how many years I've said no way, is the answer then to have the universities or the conferences or the NCAA, whatever body ends up existing, paying the players directly, and then they're basically being contracts so that players then stay. They're committed now that the university has made them employees, as opposed to them leaving? Because as I watch the tournament, I cannot help but think, every time I see one of the mid-majors or smaller schools, that when a player does well, I sit there and go, well, as soon as their run is over, they're being recruited by a Power Five school to leave.
Well, let me give you this. This isn't just the beginning. This started a little ways back. Now, we know all the stuff go all the way back, but there's something that created this monster. And I'm going to tell you, what we created was the fifth-year transfer rule. I don't know if we talked about that, but that was such a rule that changed the dynamics of college athletics. Now, the fifth-year transfer rule has been in for many years. It's not something new, but no one really used it. The only one used it was football. You know, a kid would be, let's say, a quarterback. He didn't get to play, so he finished his fourth year and gets his degree. Now he can go anywhere he wants to go to get another degree. I mean, that means to get his master's degree. They didn't forget about that. They just said, hey, we don't care where you go, just get someplace. And now what's happening is you would lose that player. Now with the transfer portal, and with the last rule they just passed that you can go anytime, how many times, man, I had a coach tell me the other day that if you want any information to figure this thing out, go to the NBA and ask them about what happens in free agency. You'll see exactly what's happening in the world today. And he's exactly right.
You know, I wanted to ask, it obviously would impact you at the NIT. There's a lot of talk about every year about teams that get snubbed. The Big East obviously had lots of complaints, even though all of their teams lost in the first round of the NIT, the ones that they really wanted to get into the tournament. So that doesn't help their case. But then you get a Virginia in the tournament who is barely competitive on the court, who doesn't make the committee's case. And then you have coaches talking about expanding the tournament.
Right.
Where are we going with this tournament where you don't dilute the product that they have, but you come to some compromise that, I don't know, leaves the NIT intact? Or, like, I don't know, where are we going with these postseason tournaments?
Yeah, I don't either. You know, think about it in football where, you know, everyone can go to a bowl if you're 500.
Yeah,
you know,
Jeff's got complaints about that too, don't worry.
But when you have all that, you know, and what I get it, what they're saying is we want more opportunities for our kids after the season's over. But I get all that. But, you know, the NCAA tournament has been tremendous over the years. Now, with the little guy you seen last night, you know what happened with Oakland. I mean, you just don't see that in anything else. In football, if you put a mid-major football team against a Power Five football team, you know what would happen to that. People would get hurt. There'd be some injuries out there. But in college basketball, you know, this is what's so unique about it. And if that ever goes away, you really took away something that was very exciting. Now, extending it, adding more teams, you know, I can see that happening. I can, because if you add another day, you can add another 30 teams. So it's not like you're taking a long period of time and you're giving some support to other schools. However, I don't know where does it stop. Think about it. You add another 30 teams, then all of a sudden the other 15 that didn't get in, they're playing, hey, we need to get in too. So, you know, you never stop. That's why the NIT is so valuable. And if the teams understand how valuable that is, because I'm gonna give you a prime example of this. Wisconsin. A year ago, they were the only really major Power Five team to make a commitment to the NIT. Now, there were some others that went in, but they made a commitment to it. And their coach said, we're going in it because we're developing our team for next year. So when we play again next year, we can have success. Look at this year. They've almost won the Big Ten championship, and now they're in the NCAA, and you don't know what will happen today, but I think they'll be highly, highly competitive.
Yeah, why? You're right. I just don't see why we need to expand it. There's always going to be a bubble. Unless you have every single team, somebody's always going to be griping that they should have been in. So yeah. Why make, if you can't make it as one of the 68 teams,
right.
Not go to the NIT where you can still compete? Yeah, you can get ready for next year, but you can also, you're also teaching student athletes to continue to compete. There's, and they're giving them a chance for some of them, especially for seniors, a chance to play one more time. To me, there's value in that.
It's all value with it. And I'll give you an example of that. When I was at Rutgers, my third year there, my first year, we went to the NIT, okay? And our players didn't want to go because we thought we were in the big dance and we didn't make it. It was on the last second shot kind of concept, and everybody was frustrated. So,
I remember that, Coach.
See, and everybody was frustrated. I get it, and I understand it. But then I didn't really talk to the kids. I just said, hey, we're going into the NIT because we needed to get our program going. We went in there, and they didn't come to play. They didn't come to play. And it was the worst experience I had with the NIT because we let Yale beat us on our own home court. And I thought it was really crazy.
I remember that also, Coach.
You remember that too. Then 2 years after that, we had a real good year. And it was coming to an end that we ended up losing at Virginia Tech on a tip-in at the buzzer. And that really, because we were going to get a NCAA bid. That was set if we win that game. Then we lose it, boom, they tip it in. And I'll tell you, I'll never forget that experience because when they tipped it in, I'm standing there looking at it as they tipped it in. And I tell you who was, Seth Greenberg was the coach at Virginia Tech. And he came up to me to shake my hand and he grabbed my hand because I was still looking at the mask and I was so stunned. So we didn't go. So I, in my mind, I said, hey, you know, I don't know if they're going to be excited about going to the NIT. So I brought the whole team together. I had my coaches do up a contract that, you know, that if you want to play in this, you sign this contract. Because I wanted to make sure they were going there to compete. And then they said, and they all said, yeah, we want to do it. They wanted to compete. They signed the contract. And I tell you what was unique. After they signed that contract, that night we had a practice. It was the greatest practice we had all season because they were just excited about being there. Then we got in the tournament. And if you remember, we ended up beating West Virginia. We beat Villanova. We beat Temple. We got to the finals.
We made a run.
No, it was a good run. And something, now here's the uniqueness about it. Something that every player on that team will remember the rest of their lives. That's why the NIT is a valuable resource. You need to get in there and you need to do your best and enjoy that experience because it's a great, great experience. And we should have won the national title. We just missed it by a few points. But let me tell you what that means. See, it's the NIT, it's the NCAA. You still put up on those banners, national champion. And that's what you should, you know, that's what you're playing for. And that's what it's all about.
Did you blame the ref?
You gotta go back there. You're just upset that he agreed with me. That's where it is, Coach. You've given me a sound clip that will last long after your appearance on this particular show. Before we let you go, it is a good lead-in, though, to you got a new book coming out. Your son wanted you to do this one more than you did. Tell us about your book coming out about leadership, which is clearly reflected in how you handled those situations with Rutgers both years.
Well, let me tell you this, though. You mentioned the one I'm writing right now. That's the one I'm writing, the one on leadership. However, I finished one that's ready to come out in the next month, and it's called Coaching Millennials from a Character Perspective.
Oh, that's now, important now.
Yeah, why millennials? Because that's when I was at Rutgers, and I'm talking about our experience at Rutgers with millennials. So, and you, Jason, being from the past of Rutgers, this will be great. You'll love this book.
I will be reading.
Okay. So that's coming out in about a month. But now what I'm doing, I'm on a new venture and I'm writing on my next book and it'll be my third one. And it's I titled it Leaders Are Born If Not Discovered. And I'm talking about how do you become a leader? Are you born being a leader or you grow and develop into a leader? And so I'm talking about that throughout the whole book. That's my objective. But the other part I'm talking about are the different leadership styles. And what I've come up with is 12 different leadership styles. And each chapter will be a leadership style. And the key to all this is if you're a leader, you have to define who you are and decide what type of leadership you want to run, whatever business, whatever you're doing. However, you need to be aware of all the other leadership styles, because you may have to use the things that are within those leadership styles to run your business. For instance, you know, it starts all the way. I'm starting with authoritarian. Okay, you deal with that. Okay, now today in our society, authoritarian or autocratic leader is not accepted. The kids today don't want to deal with that. So now, you know, transformational, they love, because now they're being active, they're being a part of everything. And so it's going to be a great book. I'm really excited about it, because now leaders get to understand what it's all about, but at the same time, look at themselves and say, do I want to be this type of leader?
It seems like an interesting trajectory between your books, between character coach to then coaching millennials to then leadership. It seems like they all fit together very nicely in terms of the
story. Well, I'm glad you said that, because in the book, you know, I talked about the title of it, but then there's a subtitle that says, what is it like coaching the millennials, okay, in certain generations. So that's the subtitle to it. So when you think about that, you have to think about the whole process and why do you become a leader. And today in our society, you know, I read a book, you know, now to write this book, I done got together about 12, 13 books just to do research on. But in writing it, I read a book by on Lee, you remember Lee Iacocca. Mm-hmm. And his statement was, where have the leaders gone? And think about it, in our society today, we can say that same thing. And it's just a duplication of what's going on from society or from generation to generation.
Well, we can't wait to see each of your next books come out. And when they do, we'll have to have you back to talk about it. Coach Gary Waters, thanks for always giving us some time and breaking it down and breaking down where we are in college sports. We appreciate it.
Well, it's been great talking with both you, Jason and Jeff. You've been outstanding as usual, and you make me think and make me bring out information that I shouldn't be bringing up, but I bring it out anyway. And we just enjoy ourselves.
Thanks so much, Coach. Have a great one.
Take care now.
Can't wait to talk to Coach about his next books. I didn't get to ask him, though. You want to talk about leadership or lack thereof. How about Long Beach State firing their coach before the conference tourney, then the team going on a run to win the conference tourney, and then the athletic director coming out saying, I'm not taking credit for it, but it worked. So, okay, like... Jeff, by the way, firing him with no time left on his contract, no benefits, no nothing. So he's got family, got to figure that out, separate from the money and everything. But your thoughts on the AD taking credit for the team winning the conference tournament because they fired the coach?
Well, why don't we start with the positive, with the coach himself?
Who handles it wonderfully.
He has handled this incredibly well. His student athletes are clearly loyal to him and busted their butts when they found out and played for him and themselves. And there's the positive. The negative is, if there's a single person on planet Earth that would give any credibility to the athletic director from Long Beach State, please, please show me who you are. Because for the athletic director to say that, first of all, it's completely a lie. There is no way that he sat around and said, I got an idea. I'm going to get us into the tournament by firing our coach.
Okay? Those players definitely played for the AD there, Jeff. That's what they were doing.
For those of us that are old enough to remember Major League, okay? There's no way that this is what happened, okay? And second of all, the fact that you needed to take attention away from the student athletes and the coach and give the credit to yourself when you deserve none of it, Long Beach State, your trustees, your president should be firing the athletic director and bringing the coach back. That's what should be happening.
All right. I'm going to leave it there. Why don't we hit the break? We'll come back. We'll talk some football with Michael Lombardi and then close it out. Stick with us.
Great.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm. and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
Let's talk some football. Former NFL executive, author, commentator Michael Lombardi joins the show. Thank you for the time.
It's good to be here, guys. Jason, Jeff, nice to see you.
It's great.
Get ready for the tournament. I put my Hickory jersey on because the best coach in the tournament is still Norman Dale. So we'll see how that works out.
So do you take a break from the football at this time of year to watch some March Madness?
I learn a lot about coaching from basketball coaches. I think they see the game more in matchups than football coaches do. I think they understand each game is different, so they play each game a different style. They don't try to force the style. How many times have you heard a basketball coach say, if we keep this game in the 50s, we can win. If it gets in the 70s, we got no chance. You never hear football coaches talk like that, right? So I learn a lot from basketball coaches, and so I like watching them. You know, I like, I was before I came on with you, I was writing a daily coach about the this notion that we have, you know, that kids don't want to be coached. And I was watching Danny Hurley talking to his team. And, you know, you could say, you know, it's really similar to a lot of the old school coaches. Players want to be driven, you know, and so I think that's what I like to watch about. I learned about how the coach's style is, too.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Do you think that most players still want to be driven? You're not in the college game necessarily, but you have to analyze college players. You've had to do that for a large part of your career. We talked to Ward Manuel a few years ago when the portal was coming into existence, and his warning to us and to the world was it's going to prevent or it's going to discourage kids from competing.
Yeah.
And have we gotten to the point now that the competition that young people are supposed to go through, they no longer want to go through?
Yeah. It's a great book coming out by Jonathan Haidt where he discusses this, right? And he goes through it and he calls it, you know, I'm older than both of you, but I'm pretty sure we had a play-based childhood. And those are his words. Whereas this generation has a phone-based childhood. And when you have a play-based childhood, you learn competition, right? And this has gotten me on this track because, you know, the Kenny Pickett thing has really bothered me. It's really bothered me because, you know, here he is, a first-round draft pick, has a chance to be a starter, and he opts to become a backup. Like, what does that tell you? And Hyatt's book is called The Anxious Generation, and a lot of it goes back to the upbringing of this play childhood, phone childhood. You know, when you're in a play childhood, you learn how to make mistakes, you learn how to compete, and you kind of fight through the adversity. And he has this great line in there where they talk about the fake ecosystem. There was a time in America where they were planting trees in a perfect place with perfect conditions, and they planted the trees. And what they found was because there was no wind in this perfect condition place, the trees never, the roots didn't grow stronger. They didn't develop extra hardness on the bark. And so the whole experiment was a disaster, which is a little bit like what we're dealing with in terms of if we don't let these kids learn how to compete, then we're going to get this. And there's still some out there, don't get me wrong. But the ones that want to transfer after they've been told no, you know, that's not healthy. It's good for maybe their pocketbook, but it's not healthy for their overall competitiveness.
I'm kind of wondering how we got there. I mean, we had you on last time talk about your book, Football Done Right, Setting the Record Straight on Coaches, Players, and the History of the NFL. We just went through the start of free agency, which was kind of chaos. I mean, you got legal tampering, and then you got the negotiating period, and then you got players moving all over the place, and trades, and teams getting out of contracts, and teams getting huge contracts. Can you talk about how we got here and what we saw these last couple of weeks before we get into some players and teams?
Except for the Cowboys.
Well, we don't make any moves.
I think how we got here was the popularity of the sport is incredible. And because the players share in the revenue, the cap went up. And so what looked like a lot of teams were going to probably have to be restrictive in terms of what they did, we saw teams take fairly good strategy. I think you saw the Eagles, you know, the first thing they did is re-sign one of their own players, you know, so that I think that's what this cap did. So what we saw were, it's kind of what Al Davis used to say to me all the time. At some point, kid, you got to play in the game. And what we saw was some of these teams, how do they play in the game? What do they value at positions? What are they doing? You know, and like the transfer portal, what looks new and exciting comes with problems too, right? And so when you take a player in free agency, you better really understand what you're getting and what you're paying for. And I think that's, it's a lesson in team building, right? And so that's what I liked about free agency, because the fan just sees the player, right? But the contract is really important. So for example, the Jets as of today have signed three players on 1-year contracts. Tyron Smith, he's played 30 games over the last 3 years. They've signed Mike Williams, who's played 40 games over the last 5 years. And they've signed Kenlaw from the 49ers, Javon Kenlaw, who's played 4 years and has 5 sacks. And they gave him 1-year contracts, and the three of those players add up to $30 million. And can they stay healthy? Can they produce? See, that's the question. On a piece of paper, you say, well, the Jets have improved. But on the field, have they? And I think that's what we never talk about.
You know, you talked about salaries. It's also how you fit. It's not just getting the best players, but how they fit together. And you mentioned Kenny Pickett, and obviously he didn't fit in Pittsburgh. How is he going to fit here when he was so disgruntled there?
I have no idea. I don't know. I mean, I know he's an Eagle fan growing up, but what I asked the question this way. If he didn't want to compete against Russell Wilson, are you going to believe he's going to compete if Hurts gets hurt? I mean, you know, like where his level of, you know, now you could say, well, it's a new environment and things change, but you know, he's a third year player with a fifth year option sitting out there at ridiculously good money. Like, I don't know why you wouldn't want to go compete against Russell Wilson. I was saying this on my show and on the podcast. If Kenny Pickett can't beat out Russell Wilson, he's not an NFL quarterback. And if Russell Wilson can't beat out Kenny Pickett, he's not one either. Like, it was going to be, forget the rhetoric, it was going to be competition. Because that's what the Steelers wanted. The Steelers wanted competition. And I'm just disappointed. Now, maybe there's something that happened there that I don't know, and I'm being too harsh on Kenny Pickett, but I have a hard time understanding how you gave up a chance to be a starter, to be a backup for a guy that's going to play all the games.
Well, you say that the Steelers want competition. Why is the first thing they did when they traded for Justin Fields to say that Russell Wilson's the starter?
Because I think they want to defuse all that. I think they wanted to defuse that. I think they told they didn't want this. Because the Justin Fields momentum is incredible. Do you realize today Justin Fields has a higher MVP odds than Russell Wilson does? I can't explain the Justin Fields phenomena to both of you. I can't explain it. I don't understand it. It's a runaway train that I can't catch. And so, but I think to me that if you know how Mike Tomlin operates, if Pickett would have been good, he would have been able to be the starter. I think they wanted it. They drafted him. Now, maybe he endeared, maybe that locker room became toxic for him. I don't know. And I don't know. But to me, I found that I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around that.
You talk about putting the pieces together in the salaries outside of Kenny Pickett. What do you think about the pieces that the Eagles put together? Jeff has gone back and forth with me about whether the coaches were the problem or the players were the problem last season. Are the new coaches that are coming in going to be able to work with the players? What's your thought on where this team stands going into the draft now?
Well, I think, look, they told you exactly what they thought. And, you know, they went from 60 sacks last year out of the 70 that they got to mid-40s in their sack. Their all defensive line was disappointing. So you could just see, you know, they wanted, you know, Riddick's available. They moved the roster bonus to April 1st. You know, they redid Sweat's deal. So they basically said to you in free agency, our defensive line was disappointing. And some of that was on them. I mean, both those tackles got out of shape and didn't play to the level. And so I think what Philly tried to do is improve what they always do. Philly behaves in a manner that comes from the owner, that he believes the game's won up front. And then I think what the other thing I think they got to was, look, we are committed to Hurts. And to make Hurts a better player, we have to have a legitimate running game. And for them to pay for a running back when they typically never did to play behind a good line, I think to me, it's a smart move. Here's what I don't understand about what goes on in the league. A slot receiver can make, you know, I mean, Gabe Davis just made $13 million down in Jacksonville per year. You know, he's going to catch 50 balls, 45 balls, right? You know, maybe he'll average 13 yards a catch. Great. Okay. I mean, Barkley's going to touch the ball 200 times, right? He's going to touch in the running game. He's going to touch it another 50 to 60 in the passing game. Like, that's not more valuable than what a slot receiver brings to the table. That's why Tyler Boyd's not getting a contract. So I think it was a smart signing, and I think people see it as, well, you know, it's, they paid for their – yeah, they did. But he's an elite player. He's a really good player, and he's going to make Hurts a better player. Sometimes the player forces you to remind you what you really should be doing, right? I think Miles Sanders made a big difference to their team 2 years ago, and they kind of thought that they could replace him, and I think the cold water on their face this offseason was – maybe it's harder to replace him than we thought.
Barkley made Daniel Jones a better player too. Without him, where do the Giants go?
Well, the Giants have a hard time being honest with themselves. They have violated the golden rule that I believe in tremendously, which is if you can't evaluate your own team, how are you going to evaluate somebody else's? Right? Like I mean, I'm on record as saying the Daniel Jones contract was it was ridiculous. I'm on record as saying that. You know, they all laughed at me. They all said I'm a Giant hater. You know, whenever you attack a team's players, you become a hater. You know, I said that Justin Fields wasn't a good player. You're a Bears hater. I said Trubisky wasn't a good player. Well, you're a Bears hater. They never tell you you're right. They just say you're a hater.
So who do you like?
Oh, I like Lamar Jackson. I like a lot of guys. You know, I didn't love Hurts when he came out.
Right.
I really didn't think he could throw with anticipation. But I feel like they've done a really good job, and Barkley helps that run game. Barkley gives them a bigger play action pass game too. So I agree with you. Where do the Giants go? Look, they're sniffing around every quarterback in the draft. What does that take? But what happened? They're a year too late. They should never have paid. Last year, I did a video about how the Giants had the disease of me, the Pat Riley theory, right? It got over 4 million views. Giant fans were ready to kill me. And I said, when they paid Daniel Jones all that money, it destroyed their team because everybody in the locker room knew he wasn't the best player. And what happened? And then Barkley comes out and says, and a lot of players come out and say, well, that was not what we wanted. So we'll see. I mean, their talent level is not where it needs to be, in spite of what they've done this offseason.
What is Dallas doing or not doing this offseason other than saying that the market is too inflated? Which if my executive said that, I would lose my mind.
Well, I think Dallas has two issues. I think what Jerry said, you know, we're going all in, was misinterpreted. Jerry said he was going all in to sign Parsons. He was going all in to sign Lamb. He didn't say he was going all in to sign Dorrance Armstrong. He didn't say he was going all in, you know, to re-up some other players. So I think to me, you know, that's it. I think that I've said this all year. I think the Cowboys overachieved. I don't think they underachieved. I don't think they're an elite team talent-wise. I really don't. I mean, think about this. Tyron Smith signed for $6.5 million on a one-year contract with the Jets. He would have stayed now, $6.5 million. All right. It's a tax-free state in Dallas. Now, playing for the Jets, we, as we know, living in New Jersey, as I do, it's a pretty heavy-duty sack state. So if the Cowboys would have offered $5.5 million, it would have been a better deal for him, right?
Right.
And they didn't even offer that. He took the Jet deal. What does that tell you about him? But what does that tell you about the Cowboys? They're going to move Tyler Smith out there? I think this is a regroup year for the Cowboys. I really do. I think it's a reboot.
Well, they paid Dak $59 million.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and they have no running back. I mean, who's going to be the ball carrier? Not that I thought that Pollard was playing great last year. I didn't. I think Pollard was coming off the knee and he didn't look like the same player.
You talk in your book about Hall of Famers who should and shouldn't be a Hall of Famer. Well, one person you haven't talked about yet because he just retired in this city is Jason Kelce. What's your evaluation of whether or not he should be in or shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, and will you include him in that book 10 years from now?
Well, I think you're asking me, is he a top 100 player? I probably have to go through it more in detail and compare him. You know, and I think you have to kind of the center position back in the old days when some of those guys played center, there was nobody lined up over the nose. They were always in a two technique. And so you have to kind of take a little bit of that with a grain of salt. You know, was he better than Mike Webster? Was he better than Dwight Stevenson? That's hard for me to really, I can't see that, you know, I can't see that. But Dwight Stevenson, who nobody remembers, I'm sure you guys do, was incredible. Damani Dawson was the best center I've seen play against. Damani Dawson was rare. You know, so I would say, you know, I'd have to do more. He's not like, okay, I'm just going to vote for him to be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, from a popularity standpoint, he certainly is going to get in the Hall of Fame. I mean, this idea that we should waive his 5 years to get him in the Hall of Fame by some Eagle fans, I mean, are we kidding? We didn't waive it for Peyton Manning. Did you hear they want to take Rocky statue down and put Kelsey up?
Oh, I have not heard that, but it does not surprise me.
We never get carried away in this city. Never, ever.
No, it's remarkable. Look, I think he certainly qualifies for the lottery consideration. Charles Haley was not a first ballot Hall of Famer. I mean, is Haley better than Kelsey? I mean, they're two different positions, but I know Haley, and he changed the game. It'll be interesting to see. But all this, though, is still a, you know, we're still talking about a popularity thing, Jeff. I mean, it's a lot of the Hall of Fame, and I'm not suggesting that Kelsey's going to get in just solely on popularity. He's a really good player, smart player, too, which I think they're going to miss. I think they're going to miss him a lot, especially with all of the audibles they run at the line of scrimmage when they run that quarterback draw. But I just don't think it's a slam dunk because nobody goes back and looks at how good Damani Dawson was or how good, you know, some of these other guys were. Dwight Stevenson, Jesus, God.
Before we let you go, we know you'll be putting out a lot of great content in the weeks leading up to the draft. Where can people find your podcast? Can they get your book? Tell us where to find you.
Well, I mean, I'm unfortunately everywhere. Find me on Twitter, M Lombardi NFL, Instagram, M Lombardi NFL. It's just social media so bad. Every time I go on it, I'm like, why? This is ridiculous. But you can find it there. The book's still available in all bookstores. And, you know, it'll be, you know, I had Aaron Donald in the top 50 when I wrote the book because I knew he was getting ready to retire. I wasn't sure it was going to be this short. But, you know, the one guy I regret when I wrote the book, I didn't have Mahomes in the top 100. He had only won one Super Bowl when I was writing the book. So I kind of thought I would have time. And, you know, already your top 100 is outdated.
It's got to be hard.
I just have one more question for you.
Sure.
You seem to be a real historian or a lover of the history of the game. In talking to people from different sports, it seems that the NFL spends less time talking about its history than a lot of other sports. Why is that?
Yeah, because of the size of the player, because they don't think that Mike Webster could block today because the players are too big. When Mike Webster would look a lot like Jason Kelsey in terms of how his body was, right? I mean, Webster, when he was drafted in the fourth round at Wisconsin, weighed 245. You know, eventually he got bigger. So I think a lot of it is because the perception is the athletes today are so much better than the athletes of yesterday. So let's just dismiss it, you know? And I think that's kind of unfair to the athletes of yesterday. There's some great athletes that we didn't really get to see the true athletic, John Mackey, Ditka, those guys. I mean, the one position we do not have, as great as all these athletes are in our NFL today, we don't have tight ends. I was talking to Belichick the other day about it. Where are all the great on the line, the John Mackeys, the Mike Ditkas, the Jackie Smiths, the guys who can block a 9 technique or block a 7 technique in the run game, and then the Ron Kramer, who can't even get in the Hall of Fame, and he's one that was an all-decade player. Where are those guys in the league? You don't find them. If you can call Kelsey a tight end, you can, okay? But he's a wide receiver, and he's a great one, don't get me wrong. Right. But he's a wide receiver. He blocks a support guy. He doesn't block the 9 technique or the 8 technique. So that position is a dinosaur. The big linebacker that could run, that's a dinosaur as well. Ray Nitschke, I always remember when I was preparing for the book, I spent time with Ron Wolf, and he was like, look, I'm just telling you, Ray Nitschke could fly. And nobody thinks that way. And I think there's a lot of that. We don't honor the past. I love it when we all think that the offenses that we're all running today are just the same. You know, they're all inventive and they're all stuff that was running before.
Well, we will keep taking you, coming on and talking about the past anytime you want to tell us how we got here and what it means going forward. Michael Lombardi.
Well, I appreciate you guys.
We always appreciate you giving us some time. Look forward to following what you're putting out in the next couple of weeks. You have a great one.
Thank you so much, guys. Appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Mike, we really appreciate the time.
Anytime, guys. I appreciate you.
There'll be so much to talk with Lombardi about in the coming weeks as we lead into the draft and everything else with free agency, but he's just a font of knowledge in terms of how we got here.
What I would be doing right now is asking you the date of the draft, but we know how well that goes.
You know, I'll get that wrong. you know that won't work out well.
Yes.
All right.
You know what? Here's your mission is you need to make like a little thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we have documents that we share that our ideas before shows. We need to have a separate document that has important dates and we'll put all the sports drafts on there. How's that?
So that I cannot check it before I say the wrong date on the air. Is that what you're looking for?
Well, I could screw around with it and just change the dates right before the show.
We got less than 2 minutes left. I want to ask you, are you surprised that the Flyers have sat Sean Couturier 3 weeks after making him the captain?
We have 2 minutes left on a tourney weekend and you're going to hockey?
I just have to. Well, do you want to talk more tourney?
No. Okay. You go ahead.
Go to
talk
tourney.
To hockey for, it's a really substantive talk when we only have 2 minutes left. But if you want to have this discussion, this is Tortorella is now getting to Tortorella time. Like, we all know that he's got a shelf life as a coach. We've been very impressed by what he's done since he's been here. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes, obviously. Maybe there's something more to this, but I don't think that the Flyers haven't had a captain for years, right? A couple of years since Giroux left. They name a captain right before the trade deadline when we all thought that Couturier would be one of the people that got traded. Because I remember when he got named a captain, you and I were texting each other going, well, I guess he's not being traded.
Yeah.
And then after the trade deadline, he's a healthy scratch, and it keeps coming out that he's a healthy scratch, which makes no sense, because if he was such a leader, then you would think it would be important for him to be out there when he's healthy.
And he's telling you he's unhappy that he's a healthy scratch and that he's working hard. So I don't know what's going on there. The Flyers are still in playoff position. You think they're going to hold on? This will be the last word for you.
I don't know, but I don't know how you can hold him out if you thought he was good enough not to trade and that he was to make him a captain.
I guess we see what they end up doing. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.